Today, for this sex offender joint subcommittee working group, we have a couple of presentations. The first one is from John Kerwin, who is the assistant Hennepin County attorney, to give us a civil commitment from the county's perspective.
Members. I'm John Kerwin from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm going to talk about some issues relating to the civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons under our two statutes that we use in Minnesota. I do that type of work for Hennepin County, and I'm also a member of the Civil Commitment Subcommittee of the County Attorneys Association. I have with me at the table Paul Scoggin from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Paul is the manager of the Criminal Prosecution Division of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And I know in previous hearings, the members have raised many questions about criminal sentencing practices as they relate to sex offenders. So Paul will be available to answer any questions the committee might have about that. I'm going to talk very briefly about our two commitment statutes. And I'm not going to go over the specifics, the requirements of the statute in detail. I know you've heard that from Senate counsel. But there are 1939 psychopathic personality statute, and then the more recent statute enacted in 1994, the sexually dangerous person law. And I'm going to briefly touch on some constitutional constraints that relate to some of the issues that members of the committee have raised. And also I'm going to talk about some substantive and procedural requirements and issues that, again, either the committee members have raised or that relate to things that you've raised. Constitutionally, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that there are two legitimate purposes, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, that can be served by civil commitment. And one is what we call the parents' patriae power of providing care to someone, so acting in that person's best interest. The other is the police power, where civil commitment is used to protect the public. And our Supreme Court, in the Blodgett case in 1994, made it very clear that commitments under the psychopathic personality law and then later under the sexually dangerous person law are done pursuant to this police power. So they're public protection kinds of civil commitment. The United States Supreme Court, in the case called Kansas versus Hendricks in 1997, upheld the Kansas sexually violent predator commitment law. And the court rejected claims on a number of bases that you'll often hear raised in this context. Substantive due process, double jeopardy, ex post facto laws. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected all of those claims. Even the dissenting justices in the Hendricks case really agreed that civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons is an appropriate thing to do. The dissent simply, in that case, thought that Kansas wasn't making a legitimate attempt to provide treatment. But that's what the dissent thought was wrong with the Kansas law. And in terms of treatment, because I know that's maybe the main thing that this committee is dealing with, it deals with sex offenders, there have been a number of cases that talk about what the constitutional significance of treatment is. Our Supreme Court in the Blodgett case in 1994 said that even when treatment is problematic, and it often is, the court said, so long as the civil commitment is programmed to provide treatment and periodic review, due process is provided. And so essentially what they were saying is that this will be a difficult group of people to treat, but the state has to make its best efforts. In the Hendricks case, the U.S. Supreme Court basically said the same thing. They said that even where the state's overriding concern was the continued segregation of sexually violent offenders, so again, a police power commitment, that commitment was appropriate, especially where it was combined with the state's ancillary goal of providing treatment to those people, if such as possible. So again, they were saying the state really has to do its best to provide treatment. The court specifically said in Hendricks that if persons are untreatable, that doesn't mean that the state cannot commit them for the protection of the public. The most specific explanation of what the constitutional significance of treatment is was probably in Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion in the Hendricks case. In a later U.S. Supreme Court case called Kansas versus Crane, Justice Breyer wrote the majority opinion, so he clearly is one of the leading thinkers on this issue. And in blue on the screen, I put what he actually said, and then in yellow, I give you what I think is the summary of what he said, and that's this: that where the state can fine somebody for the protection of society, not for the person's own good, and where the state's goal is not to punish the person, then the state has to use the least harsh, the least restrictive means to confine the person. And one of the parts of that is, if you're confining the person not for his own good but for the protection of the public, you have, to the extent you can, you have to provide them the means to be able to achieve their freedom and to limit the period of their confinement. So again, the requirement is for states to do the best they can. In the last meeting of this committee, there were some questions raised about the inability to control standard as part of both of our commitment statutes. And the question was, is that really a good commitment standard? Does it really describe a mental health diagnosis? I'm not a big proponent of that standard, but both the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have said that it is a constitutionally required standard. And so the reason that we use that in these cases is not because it's the language that psychiatrists necessarily use or even like, but it's what the Supreme Courts have required. One of the limitations that applies constitutionally in these cases is a limitation on harmfulness. How harmful does behavior have to be before we can use this fairly drastic remedy of civil commitment? And in a case called Rickmeyer in 1994, the Minnesota Supreme Court overturned the commitment of a pedophile who had touched children in the park, spanked their bare buttocks, touched their private parts. It was unclear exactly what that meant in that case. But they said that Rickmeyer's conduct wasn't harmful enough to use this measure, and then they said what the standard was. And they said that it's conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical or mental harm being inflicted on the victims. And so that's another one of the limits that applies here, how harmful the conduct has to be. Another one of the limitations that applies is likelihood. And our SDP statute says that the person has to be likely to engage in harmful sexual conduct in the future. But our Supreme Court, in one of the Linehan cases, says that in this context, likely means highly likely. And they specifically said that a standard of more likely than not, say, for example, the person is 51% likely to commit a new offense, that that's not a high enough standard. Instead, that it has to be a highly likely standard. I don't know exactly what that means numerically, but it's something significantly higher than a 51% standard. Other states don't necessarily use a likelihood standard that high. And I know one of the questions the committee has had is, you know, what are the differences in the commitment laws in some states, either procedurally or substantively? Minnesota uses the highest likelihood standard of any state. It has to be highly likely. Some states require only that the future conduct be more likely than not to occur. Some states require less than that. California, for example, says that the conduct need not even reach a 50% likelihood. And that if the conduct the person engages in is sufficiently serious, that a likelihood of less than 50% would be sufficient. Minnesota requires that the person have engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct, which by definition means at least two incidents of harmful sexual conduct. Not all states require that. Again, picking California as an example, they require that the person have committed an offense against one or more victims. One of the differences in the procedures among the states is concerns the standard of proof that's required. How convincing does the evidence have to be? The United States Supreme Court addressed this issue for civil commitment in a 1979 case called Addington versus Texas, and they considered whether a preponderance of the evidence was enough, whether proof beyond a reasonable doubt was required, but the U.S. Supreme Court instead said that the standard of clear and convincing evidence is what's required. And in 1982, that was then adopted into our Minnesota statute. And Minnesota and about half of the other states use the clear and convincing evidence standard for these types of commitment cases. Just over half of the states use the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. One of the differences in procedure between Minnesota and other states is that some states use juries in these types of cases and some states don't. Of about 20 states that have civil commitment programs for sexually dangerous persons, Minnesota and about four other states have those cases tried simply to a judge. About 15 of the states use a jury. I think the question to ask about that is, do juries result in fewer commitments? Do they make it more difficult to commit a person, or do they simply make it more expensive? My answer to that would be that they simply make it more expensive. In states that have juries, what you hear in talking to people from those states is that all the jury needs to hear is what the person's offenses were, and they're ready to commit the person. And when the psychologists start talking about actuarial tools and likelihood of real offense, the jury's eyes tend to glaze over. They've heard what this person has done, and they've heard all they need to hear. So I don't think juries make it more difficult to commit a person. They simply make trials last longer. One of the issues I know that the committee has talked about is the time it takes to bring these cases first to the filing of a petition and then to trial. And so I wanted to talk with you a little bit about what are the procedural steps that are necessary to do that. As you've heard, I know in the previous meetings, most of the referrals to county attorney's offices in these types of cases come from the Department of Corrections. Not all of them do. County attorneys receive referrals from some other sources, sometimes a prosecutor who handled the case, sometimes from probation, either adult or juvenile probation, sometimes from a victim. And when a county attorney receives a referral in one of these cases, the first step is simply to look at the referral documents, look at a little handful of documents to see, is this the type of case that may even qualify for commitment? Sometimes, for example, the person has only one offense. It might be very egregious, but just by definition, we know that that won't be sufficient. So there are some preliminary screening things you can do. But if it appears that the case may meet the requirements for a commitment case, then the county attorney gathers and reviews records. One of the things you have to keep in mind is that in proving this kind of case, it's very different from the typical criminal case. Now, some criminal cases will get very involved with lots of steps and many acts and so on, but many criminal cases involve proving whether one act occurred and maybe whether the person had a particular state of mind in doing the act. In these cases, we have to prove that the person engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct, and we have to prove that the person is highly likely to engage in more harmful sexual conduct. And whether the person is highly likely to engage will depend on the person's entire history, how they've behaved on parole, how they've performed in treatment, and their course of conduct that they've engaged in. The course of conduct may include one or more previously proved offenses. The person may have been convicted of some things or adjudicated in a juvenile system. But it also might include situations where the person was charged or where the police did an investigation but didn't even charge the person because maybe there was another criminal matter that was adequately dealing with the situation. And so a county attorney working on this case may have to go back and do an investigation and be proving really a wide range of conduct that's never previously been proved and that might have occurred 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 years earlier. The course might include acts that occurred in other states. And so in some of these cases, in some cases we don't have to interview or find any victims, but in some cases we have to locate and interview one victim or three victims or five victims, for example, to adequately prove what this person's course of conduct is. The victims might be anywhere in the country. The acts might have occurred in Minnesota, but the victims have moved elsewhere, or the acts might have occurred in other states, and we have to locate victims. We have to gather records from law enforcement agencies, from prisons, from treatment facilities, and so on in other states. When we gather records, there are some records that we can get without a court order. We can get them simply for the asking. So, for example, under a statute that you've enacted, if DOC refers a file to us, we can get DOC's records by asking for them. We can get the adult criminal court records, police reports, and the prosecutor's file without a court order. But there are a number of other kinds of records that we need to get a court order. And again, the legislature has provided a statute that enables us to do that. But at least in Hennepin County, we have to provide notice to the patient. An attorney is appointed. The hearing is contested. And we first have to get that court order and then serve it on all these sources in other states to get records from the sources I've listed, treatment programs, juvenile court, and so on. Sometimes even school records are necessary, either if the offender is quite young or sometimes the person's history of misbehavior, even if he's 50 years old, goes back to his adolescence. When we get these records, they will typically be, 6 inches of records to 2 feet of records. We have to organize them, number them. In many cases, we'll then get a review of those records done by a psychologist, one or more psychologists that we retain. Hennepin County usually uses one. Some counties use a panel of 2 psychologists, and we get their opinion to help us make that decision. And then if we're going to go ahead with the case, we draft a petition. The petitions in these cases range usually from 10 to 50 pages long. We summarize the records. We're trying to make the case both to the examiners who will consider the case and to the court, explaining, again, not only what acts this person has committed, but how they've behaved under parole, supervision, and treatment, and so on, to paint the full picture of this person. I brought along with me a petition that I did in the case. It's 34 pages long, cited to the records in the case. I removed the offender's name and substituted an X for his name, even though the petition actually is a public record. But I provided that to the committee administrator, and I know she's providing it to you to hand around if you would like to take a look at it. During the last legislative session, you enacted a 4-month filing deadline, which provides that if the county attorney files a petition following a referral by the Department of Corrections or a court, the county attorney is supposed to do that within 120 days. Failure to file within 120 days doesn't then prevent the filing of a petition or doesn't invalidate a petition that would be filed. But the consequence is that the Department of Human Services is going to report to the legislature on the county attorney's success in meeting that filing deadline. Why might a county attorney not meet the filing deadline? Well, one is that it might be that those steps that I described simply can't be done within the 120 days. Some cases are simpler and the records are easily available and you don't have to locate and interview a lot of other witnesses, but in some cases that process, for any one of a number of reasons relating to all those steps, can be quite protracted. The other thing that sometimes happens is that sometimes we get a referral from the Department of Corrections a year or 14 months ahead of time, but the person is participating in treatment in prison and is doing so with some success and cooperation. And so we will intentionally wait and go past that 4-month deadline and get maybe to 6 months prior to the person's release to see how they're doing in treatment before we file the petition. Another one of the reasons that it's important to completely prepare the case before we file the petition is that once we file the petition, there's a deadline for how soon the case has to go to hearing, but the person can request that the case be set on immediately for trial, and if they make that request, then it has to go to trial within 15 days. So essentially that means we have to have all of our ducks in a row, both records and witnesses, before we file the petition. There are a few reasons why the Department of Corrections sometimes refers cases to the county attorney's office less than a year before release, and I know some of those have been described to you already, but one is the inmate will arrive in prison with less than a year remaining, either because the person has been on probation, finally the probation has been revoked and they get there and there's only 8 months remaining, for example, or the person has been on parole and the parole is revoked, gets back to prison with less than a year remaining. Another reason is that sometimes the people screening for referral to the county attorney's office have not decided to refer the case for commitment, but later the person is designated a level 3 sex offender for community notification purposes. And in those cases, when that happens, the Department of Corrections automatically refers the case to the county attorney's office. Our experience has been that, except for these types of cases, that DOC has been very successful in the last couple of years in referring the cases to the county attorney's office with the year or more notice that's required by the statute. I wanted to very briefly, as one last thing, mention the discharge process for these people, because I know one of the concerns that the committee has raised relates not only to the treatment that these people are getting in the DHS facility, but what's the process for them to get out and why is it so hard to get out. And as the committee has heard at previous hearings, there's kind of a two-step process. First, the person, or if the treatment team is supporting the release, the treatment team can ask the special review board, a body of three persons, to either discharge or more likely provisionally discharge the person from treatment. If either the person or the treatment team isn't satisfied with a refusal to release the person, they can then go to a judicial panel. And before the judicial panel, the legislature has provided that the burden in those judicial panel cases is kind of a two-step burden. First, the burden is on the person bringing the petition to the judicial panel to go forward with the evidence. And what that's called is making a prima facie case, simply showing you have enough evidence so that if there weren't any evidence on the other side, that you would have enough evidence yourself to be released. If you've met that minimal burden, then the burden switches to the county and state to prove that you're not entitled to be released. And one of the questions is from the committee, does that initial placing of the burden on the individual make it hard for the person to be released? Is that one of the stumbling blocks to release? And what I would suggest to you is it really doesn't make it harder for someone who may be entitled to be released to be released. It only means that you don't have long hearings if the person isn't even close to meeting the release standard. The only time you have to go to the second part of the hearing, where you're having to bring a bunch of treatment staff up from St. Peter or down from Moose Lake for a hearing and having that longer hearing, is if the person makes an initial showing that there's some reason to believe that they may be entitled to be released. So those are the very quick comments and overview that I wanted to provide to the committee. I'm available for any questions that you might have about the commitment and the release process. And then, as I mentioned, Mr. Scoggin is available for any questions you might have relating to the criminal sentencing issues. Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerwin, when was the last time that a petition was granted? Do you know?
The information that I have about that is that one person who was committed under one of these two statutes was provisionally discharged a few years ago. I can't recall when it was, but I'm going to guess around the year 2000, give or take a couple of years. Okay. And you probably have heard about that. And that person was provisionally discharged, was out for a period of time, and then that provisional discharge was revoked because he wasn't complying with supervision. Before that, I think it goes back to some time prior to the early 1990s.
Any other questions? I guess the question that I have is, if you are getting the cases in most situations with plenty of time from the Department of Corrections, then why are we hearing so much about the counties objecting because they aren't processed in a timely enough fashion, so they end up with a hold cost?
Madam Chair, I think that since the four-month statute went into effect last summer, I think the county attorneys have been quite diligent in attempting to meet that statute. Now, we don't have enough experience under that yet to know for sure how that's going to work. I think before that time, since the beginning of 2004, I think my county and all the counties were kind of scrambling to catch up with the glut of referrals that had occurred after that time. And so even though we would get a referral 12 months ahead of time, usually since the person wasn't going to be getting out for 12 months, that wasn't the most important matter we had to deal with. The most important matter we had to deal with was, you know, one case or a number of other cases that had release dates coming up sooner. And so I think there was a lot of catch-up going on. And when the Department of Human Services during this last session proposed that there be some sort of deadline, I think by that time the counties were feeling that they were in a position where they could agree to the four-month deadline. I think a second thing, though, that will continue to happen is that there will still be a number of referrals that come from the Department of Corrections with less than the year. And so counties will be trying to process that within those time. And in addition to that, there will be a few cases, and my office has a few of these right now, where because the person is actively participating in treatment and has some prospect of success in treatment in prison, it just seems premature to be bringing that case a year or 10 months ahead of time when it might not be necessary.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Next, Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Inter-County Association.
Madam Chair, if I can just have a second here to get up my PowerPoint. Okay, Madam Chair, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I also happen to be chairing a ad hoc working group consisting of representatives of the counties, DHS, DOC, the Attorney General's Office, and the Governor's Office on civil commitment to sex offenders, with a specific focus on counties' concerns with regards to the cost of the process that have risen substantially over the past several years. Several of the questions that were just asked, I hope I can answer better as I go through my presentation. To start with, the county's costs for civil commitment have, not surprisingly, risen along with the state's. Those costs obviously include the county attorney's costs for prosecuting the commitment petitions. Although for the 80 smaller counties in the states, that function is actually performed by the state attorney general's office. Also, our costs, we pay 100% of the hold cost while the commitment petition is being processed if the individual has completed his or her prison sentence. Even though current statute that has been in the books since 1999 provides that the state will pay 50% of that tab.
Mr. Carlson, your slide isn't quite hitting the screen there, so maybe if you can just that's good.
Perfect. I'm sorry. And finally, once the individual is indeterminately committed, the counties pay 10% of the cost of that commitment. This is the only instance where all of the state's property taxpayers are being asked to pay for the long-term confinement of individuals for public safety purposes. Now, the county's hold costs in particular have mushroomed with the increases in the number of petitions, going up nearly tenfold from 2003 to 2006, from 462,000 to over 4.1 million between 2003 and 2006. Now, you might be of the belief that that has some connection with the number of offenders in prison, but quite frankly, that's not the case. The number of offenders in the state's prisons is not a function of increased offenses or convictions for sex offenses. It's more reflective of the lengthening term of more recent offenders. What has driven the increase in the number of petitions is the policy change that was made in late 2003 after the abduction and murder of Drew Shadeen, where practically all level 3 sex offenders were referred for civil commitment. And you'll see how dramatically that increased the number of referrals by the Department of Corrections to the county attorneys. That obviously has gone hand in hand with a significant increase in the number of petitions filed by the county attorneys, going from 84 in the FY04-05 period to an estimated 138 in the FY06-07 period. concomitantly, admittances have gone up, as has the patient or caseload of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program facilities. I think it's perhaps surprising, although perhaps the committee has seen this before, 80% of the admits to MSF facilities at St. Peter and Moose Lake are actually for individuals on temporary holds. It's not for those indeterminately committed. On the other hand, I do want to make it clear that the actual amount of bed days being occupied are much more leaning towards those who are indeterminately committed. But nevertheless, 80% of the admits in FY 2006 were those on temporary holds. Now, I've gone through many of the factors that are leading to the increase in the number of petitions and commitments, but one of those is not simply a knee-jerk reaction by the county attorneys. They are not simply receiving the referrals from the Department of Corrections and then immediately turning around and filing a petition for every referral that they receive. In Dakota County, for instance, between 2003 and 2007, they received 58 referrals. Only 20 of those actually resulted in petitions when this information was aggregated in the middle of this year. Another 9 were pending consideration, and then 10 were referred to the county of residence or county of financial responsibility. So some may be more generated. But again, the bottom line consideration is not every referral results in a petition being filed. I do want to correct a couple of what I believe are misperceptions. First of those is that counties are routinely receiving 12 months' notice for civil commitments from the Department of Corrections. In fact, based on the statistics for 2006, in less than one-third of the cases for which petitions were filed was notice received with 12 months or more notice. That's not due to ineptness or lack of attention to this form of function by the Department of Corrections. I'll go shortly into the reasons why, but I want to say at the outset, it's not due to the Department of Corrections failing to follow through. Again, of the 170 offenders forwarded for consideration for commitment to the county attorneys, 65 petitions have been filed for those individuals at the time this information was put together by the Department of Corrections, and those resulted in 57 holds. Out of those 65 cases in which petitions were filed, 21, or less than one-third, were forwarded with more than 12 months' notice, and 44 were forwarded with less than 12 months' notice. Now, of those 44, the primary reason has already been touched on. 32 were simply offenders who are what I would characterize as short-timers. They serve less sentences of 13 months or less with DOC. Then there was the next group of roughly 3 are basically individuals who were not caught at the front end when the department does its civil commitment referral, which usually occurs between 14 and 12 months before relief, but rather at the end of confinement review when the risk assessment for community notification is decided. At that time, for the 5 offenders next noted, and then the 1 offender previously subsequently noted two more steps down, new information became available, whatever, and they decided that those individuals did warrant referral for civil commitment. A couple of the others, basically their sentences were changed during the time they were in prison, and what appeared to be more than enough time to get them suddenly had dropped to a substantially lesser period of time because either a new sentence was given or jail credit was given to the individual making notice. Finally, one individual, they acknowledged, just simply dropped through the cracks. Now, the department would want me to acknowledge that of the 65 petitions that were filed, 35 were probation and supervised release violators, which quite frankly, are particularly problematic in the counties getting sufficient notice. 23 of those are what I would believe are probation violators because they are new admits. And the department would contend that the counties should already be cognizant of that. I'm willing to acknowledge that in the case of the Community Corrections Act counties, where these individuals are being supervised by actual county employees, I'm not so sure that that's quite so clear-cut in the DOC or CPO counties, where these individuals are being supervised by Department of Corrections employees. And then in the final 2 and 10 or 12 cases, they're supervised release violators, individuals who are serving the final one-third of their sentence generally out in the community. And I'll go into some more detail about them shortly. Okay, the second common misperception, again, was somewhat addressed early, and that is that last session's change that require county attorneys to file commitment petitions within 120 days of the referral has not functioned to ameliorate the county's hold cost. I'm not sure how clear it was in the committee's mind, but basically the filing of the petition just formally initiates the commitment process. There are a number of other steps that occur after that that frequently won't run for several months and has a consequence during that period. These individuals are on hold in MSOP facilities, and counties are picking up the tab during that. I've got a couple possible changes that have been discussed within the context of my working group. I do want to make it clear the work group has not made any formal recommendations, but since we have this venue, I thought I'd put them up for the committee's consideration. The first of those is probably obvious. Appropriate money to pay for the state's statutory 50% share of the hold cost. This provision has been on the books since 1999, and only in one biennium was any money appropriated for that purpose. The second, those go to the supervised release violators, the 12 on the prior page that I previously referred to. If those individuals come back for either a technical violation or a new offense, the suggestion here would be simply keep them in the DOC facilities until the end of their executed sentence or until they're committed, instead of sending them back to the county and having them turn around and initiate the petition and incur the hold cost. This isn't, frankly, breaking new ground, because that is exactly what happens with supervised release violators if they happen to be in DHS MSOP facilities. If they either technically violate or commit a new offense while they're in St. Peter or Moose Lake, they're bumped right over to the DOC facilities. Next one came from the Department of Corrections, and this is to possibly consider dual commitments at the time of sentencing to both DOC facilities for the criminal sanction as well as subsequently to a DHS facility for the commitment. This would be particularly helpful, in their opinion, in dealing with the short-term offenders. The finally might be nonsensical, but I'll explain more. And that's for sex offenders who have been petitioned for civil commitment, who have completed their terms of imprisonment, to allow them to elect to stay at DOC or county correctional facilities instead of at the more expensive Minnesota sex offender program facilities. The rationale behind this is for these individuals, if you give them a choice, do you want to go to St. Peter or Moose Lake or stay at the prison where you may have just come out? In many cases, and this has in fact happened in the past, they will elect to stay at the facility that they're familiar with. The other option of putting them in a county correctional facility is it allows them to maintain the connection to their family, to their friends, and perhaps their legal counsel, instead of what they would lose if they go to the frequently more distant St. Peter or Moose Lake facilities. I just have a few more comments about the supervised release violators who are subsequently referred for civil commitment. I think, again, this has been brought to the attention of the committee at previous meetings, but 40% of those individuals in MSOP facilities have time remaining on their sentences. And the reason why is because of the state's sentencing guidelines, where generally one-third of that sentence is served on supervised release out in community. The Department of Human Services, with the cooperation of DOC, has frankly taken advantage of this, and any time that those supervised releasees have violated or committed a new offense while they're in the DHS facilities, they've been sent right back to the DOC prisons facilities. Again, what we're suggesting is exactly the same should be done for those supervised release violators who violate out in the community and then are subsequently referred for civil commitment. Finally, with regards to the dual commitments, actually current statute that has existed since 1989 actually contemplates this, that at the time of sentencing for criminal sexual conduct crimes, the court make a preliminary determination whether a petition for civil commitment is appropriate, and then refer that on to the county attorney. But in actuality or practice, that has been rarely exercised. For a period between 1989 and 1994, when the sexual offender commitment law was recodified, there were, as I understand, a few dual commitments. But the order in which those commitments occurred was basically, to my understanding, first to the DHS facilities, followed by incarceration in DOC facilities. What this, that's my understanding, is suggesting is just the reverse. The individual would first serve his or her criminal sanction at the DOC facility, and then at the completion of that, go on to the DHS facility. So with that, Madam Chair, I've completed my presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Just one question, and that is, before we ordered the county attorneys to process within 120 days the hold orders, we found a great disparity in counties around the state in terms of their ability to process people before a hold order would go into effect. And so there were some counties that were actually implementing the policy before we made it a statewide policy. And we were finding that those counties were processing more hold orders in a timely fashion so that they were avoiding the hold order costs. And so we figured it would have some impact on the amount of counties and the amount of their hold order costs if we suggested to every county attorney that they follow the procedure that had been used in some counties previous to that.
Madam Chair, I think, as the committee members know, that DHS, as part of that law, is required to report on the extent to which counties are meeting that schedule. And I anticipate, in fact, that maybe that might improve, but I guess I'd make, again, 2 points. One, the filing of the petition does not stop the hold cost. Two, there are a number of factors, as Mr. Kerwin went through. I guess I will throw another one out there, and that is the practice that I can't say is universal, but is certainly commonplace within certainly the metropolitan area, and that's where the referrals under law go back to the county on which the last conviction occurred. The financial responsibility for the commitment is with the county of residence of that individual. So if the county of financial responsibility happens to be separate from the county of last conviction, some time is lost in shifting the referral from the initial county of conviction to the county of financial responsibility. I guess the final point I make is that basically, there are seven counties that do this function directly. Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, Washington, Dakota, St. Louis, and Olmsted, I believe, and the other 80 are done by the Attorney General's office. So I quite frankly don't know if there's a distinction between the two, but there's also obviously some time lag between the county receiving it and then contacting the Attorney General's office to request that they process the case. That's frankly the only information that I can provide in response to your question.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, you were talking, you showed us the slide about sentencing time remaining, and you said that one of the potential solutions here was that if they violate in the community, they could go back to the DOC. And maybe I didn't quite understand what you meant, but I thought that if they're still on their parole and they violate, don't they already go back to the DOC and the commitment process could be proceeding during that time? What did I miss there?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, you're correct. If an individual violates while out on supervised release, they are sent back, or generally sent back, to DOC, where the hearings and release unit determines what, if any, sanction to place on that individual. Generally, those sanctions in the most severe form, based on the guidelines that I'm seeing, would be 150 to 180 days. It's not to the end of their sentence. What I'm suggesting is that if the events that occurred during their release out in the community are such that it precipitates a subsequent referral for civil commitment, then that sanction should be that they stay in the DOC facilities to the end of their executed sentence, not just that relatively short period, to give both the counties a longer time to process the commitment petition and also to avoid the substantially higher hold cost at the DHS facilities.
Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, it sounds like this shorter sanction that's imposed, is that something that is just simply being decided at the point then when the person's returned to prison? That's a little outside of my experience. Is that something that the DOC has control over then right now, how long the person is going to be committed for at that point, to their sentence expiration?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, my understanding would be that the DOC, through its hearings and release unit, puts out guidelines as to what are the sanctions for the violations that occur while on supervised release. And my belief is that they basically have carte blanche to change those. So there may be legal impediments that I, as an attorney, am not aware of, but it is an administrative function as it exists right now.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, then it sounds like there's some, you know, maybe what we need there is not so much a law change as sort of a practice change between the Department of Corrections and whoever has the information at that point that to begin those proceedings. I mean, if the person's background is such and if their violation is such that it triggers the referral, one would think that it would trigger the DOC to impose a longer period of confinement at that point, of course, only up to their expiration, and that there should be some better communication there.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that's exactly what I think is being suggested here, it will be a subject that will receive further discussions at our work meeting.
Mr. Carlson, has there been any discussion in the work group of any legal impediments to any of the recommendations that you're studying?
Madam Chair, one of the other topics that we was raised in the context of the group was whether failure to participate in treatment should result in a sanction that would extend the release state beyond the normal scheduled release date after two-thirds of the executed sentence is completed. There was a recent court case. I forget the reference. I'm sure several of the attorneys in the room know what I'm talking about, where that was put in questioner or jeopardy, basically because has a condition of participating in treatment, the offenders must acknowledge their offense. And because that acknowledgement would potentially affect their appeal rights, the court said you couldn't require that. But once the statute of limitations has run for appeal, then it seems to me that there is some possibility there. But again, the department has said they will come back to our next meeting and give us some further thoughts on the subject matter as to whether or not that's there's a possibility there.
Mr. Carlson, you know, the last presentation that we had sort of indicated to us that there would be more cases affected potentially if everyone who was considered a serious violator got treatment offered to them in prison. Not everyone gets treatment offered to them in prison, and that's a larger group than the group that are refusing treatment and then getting referred for commitment.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I mean, I've been present at your meetings, and as I understand it, roughly 20% of those whose initial screening indicate the need for treatment actually receive treatment. But I will take pains to note that participation in treatment is only a factor in determining whether or not referral occurs, according to the actuarial tools that the department uses, in one out of three instances. It's not necessarily has overriding a consideration, as I think you're inferring.
Well, even a third of the cases, if 20% of those, of that third, didn't get treatment offered to them. I mean, man, you know, at this cost, as you know, if we can reduce four a year, we're talking money.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Eric Janis.
Good afternoon. I've got some handouts. I apologize for not bringing them earlier.
While Mr. Carlson was talking, Commissioner Benson, I think, wanted to add something to the question.
Oh, well, I'm going to call him up next, so I thought maybe we just wait until he comes up and he can... So I think everyone at the table has your handout.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Eric Janis, and I'm I teach at William Mitchell College of Law. By way of full disclosure and background, I should indicate that I was involved as co-counsel for Dennis Linehan for 10 or 12 years in challenging the constitutionality of the Minnesota sex offender statutes. And so I, for quite some time, I've been an opponent, both legally and otherwise, of these commitment laws. I think they're misguided, both morally, constitutionally, and as effective tools. So with the committee's permission, I want to take a step back and talk about why I think this is a misguided direction that we're heading down. And I would like to say that it's we all agree on the goal of this legislation. I think that the particular way we've chosen to approach that goal is misdirecting the limited public funds that we have. I've written a book on this subject, recently published by Cornell University Press, and be more than happy to make available copies of the book to any members of the committee that would like to see it. But I set out my argument and the evidence for it in that book. Sex offender commitments, I don't think I need to remind the committee, challenge some very fundamental aspects of American jurisprudence. Some aspects of our jurisprudence that we fought a revolution and a civil war to secure. And these laws violate the basic ideas inherent in the compact between our government and our citizens that, in general, a person's liberty is not taken away unless they've committed a crime and been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury and then sentenced by a court. We have some limited exceptions to that notion. But this law, these laws, rip a hole in those assumptions. And they validate the notion that we as a society will be locking people up for years based not on a crime that they committed, not on punishment for a crime they committed, but because they pose a risk, and we think they might commit some undefined, unspecified crime at some undefined and unspecified place at some undefined and unspecified time in the future. So that, at least to me, is a fundamental challenge to the legal system we have in this country. And it was justified and upheld by the courts based on some key assumptions. And I want to just run through those because I think that those key assumptions have proven to be unfounded, they've been betrayed, and I think for that reason it's a very practical matter. These laws are vulnerable to further challenge, and I think that they are not the kind of laws that we as a society want to base this important task of fighting sexual violence on. So here are some of the assumptions. Number one, that there was an identifiable and limited group of the quote-unquote most dangerous sex offenders, and that through the exercise of proper expertise, we could apply very strict criteria and identify those people and lock them up. Number two, that those people would be distinguishable by their mental disorders. Number three, that they would be the most dangerous. Number four, that this was a real and valid system of civil commitment. It was not a sham. It was not an opportunistic way for the state to do what it couldn't do through the criminal law, which was extend sentences that we thought have been too short. But it really was civil commitment. And if you go back 15 years to when these laws were adopted and you read the court cases and the plans by people like Dr. Michael Farnsworth, who designed the programs, you will see that they assumed that these were going to be commitments that lasted 2, 3, or 4 years and that people were going to be out. So underlying the notion that this true civil commitment is that it ends as soon as possible. It ends when this kind of extraordinary confinement is no longer necessary, number one, and that there's real treatment offered. The next assumption was that these laws were special legislation necessitated by essentially an emergency situation, that we needed these laws as a stopgap until we could lengthen criminal sentences and take care of the problem in the legitimate way. So these were supposedly limited-time laws. And lastly, there was an assumption, never really carefully thought out, but nonetheless present, that these laws would be effective and necessary as part of a legislative plan to protect women and children from sexual violence. And part of that was a notion that we will spare no expense in fighting sexual violence. And indeed, in some ways, these laws have fulfilled that promise. We will spare no expense in funding these laws. Unfortunately, as we'll see, we do spare expense in many of the other ways that it takes to fight sexual violence. Now, in my judgment, these assumptions have been betrayed. Number one, it is simply not true that there is some careful set of criteria that identify who should be committed. There is a vague definition of someone who's likely or highly likely to commit an offense, someone who has a mental abnormality. But there is terrific vagueness and arbitrariness in that standards, and we need to look no further than this chart of the level of referrals under this law. Note, we all know what happened in December of 2003 when the referrals for civil commitment shot up and have remained high. We were operating under the same law with the same standards, and yet the referrals shot up 20-fold. It's not because the standards changed, it's because the standards provide no guidance. Here's another chart. I've been following this for some time. The bars show the level of the patient load in MSOP through the year 2000. And I draw a little trajectory, a little trend line from that. This is where this patient population would be if things kept going as they had been going before. Of course, we know that by 2007, the line had accelerated, and now we know, based on projections by the Department of Human Services, that they are projecting about 1,000 patients by the end of in 10 years. This program has no natural limits. Why not? Because the standards are elastic and provide no guidance. The statute requires some finding of mental disorder or mental abnormality. It's supposed to distinguish these individuals from other dangerous recidivists. But the key question that's asked in these proceedings is, do these individuals have difficulty controlling their behavior? And I challenge anyone here to give me a definition of what that means. It's certainly not a technical psychiatric term. Nowhere in the DSM will you find any reference to difficulty controlling behavior. What it boils down to usually is evidence that the person has not controlled their behavior, i.e. has committed crimes. But that hardly distinguishes these people from other recidivists. So the fundamental premise on which these laws are based, that there's something different in kind about these people, is false. Next, the premise was that these folks would be the most dangerous people and only the most dangerous. But what does that mean? Our courts have refused, and the legislature has refused, to say anything about what most dangerous means. Does it mean most likely to reoffend? Most likely to reoffend soon? Most likely to reoffend any time in your life? Most likely to reoffend with a serious crime, a moderate crime, a mild crime? We have no idea what it means. So part of the key problem here is that there are no standards that are used, and we've seen wild fluctuations then in the number of people and the rate at which people are committed. There are no statewide guidelines, and so we have the most expensive resource in our arsenal for dealing with sex offender violence, the most expensive resource by far, being used in a random and arbitrary way. It simply makes no sense from the point of view of a state that is serious about protecting its citizens from sexual violence. A key constitutional constraint on civil commitment that makes it different from criminal commitment is that it is to end as soon as the basis for civil commitment disappears. But we know that so far,
excuse me,
no
Mr. Janis.
Yeah, are we running out of time?
No. Your projector has gotten moved also, so thank
maybe
you.
Maybe it reflects the angle of my thought, but anyway. Okay. Off track. Thank you. I would say that the evidence is clear that that assumption is simply not being followed through. And how do we know that? Well, we've released no one so far. Well, maybe we say that's because we're doing such a good job and no one is, quote unquote, ready to get out. Well, there's a couple of, I think, very telling pieces of evidence to refute that. Number one, the director of this program, Anita Schlenk, before she was, I would say, forced out because she made these statements, indicated that about 25%, in her judgment, about 25% of the men held could be managed appropriately in the community. Number two, our neighboring state, Wisconsin, has released approximately 60 people. They have a program very similar to ours. How is it that they manage to release people and we don't? What's different about their most dangerous sex offenders compared to ours? Texas, which I have never before in my life recommended as a model, has adopted an outpatient civil commitment program in which they take their most dangerous sex offenders and they put them in a civil commitment program that's outpatient. Somehow they've managed over the years to have outpatient programs for their most dangerous sex offenders without untoward effects. Yet we seem to have been unable to release even one person. It almost makes you think that the release decision is political, not medical. And I'll tell you, if it is political, then this law is unconstitutional. We promised the courts to provide real treatment to these individuals. I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of what real treatment means. There are certainly standards for what kinds of treatment are effective. And there are plenty of people who will say that the kind of treatment that's being offered to the individuals who are currently civil committed is a shadow of what the state of the art should be. I'm not prepared to defend that statement. All I can tell you is that, again, these other states seem to have managed to move people through these programs. We have not. One explanation for that is that we simply are not doing the kind of treatment we should be doing. There was a key assumption that these were short-term laws. We could manage to, in a sense, push our constitution, our precious constitutional guarantees for a short time until we managed to get our criminal laws back in sync. But it's now been 17 years that we've been at it, and guess what? These laws haven't gone away. As we saw, they're only increasing. Why? Because they're a Pandora's box. Once you open these laws, you can't shut them. In fact, the politics are such that the inevitable result is that we will continue to expand the reach. We have not yet seen the cost that these laws are going to impose, because every time there is a tragedy, the reaction is going to be that there was a loophole that we need to plug. We need to cast the net more broadly. Let's commit more people. Finally, and this is to me the most serious, these laws are put forth as an effective and necessary part of a legislative plan to protect women and children from sexual violence. Now we know, and we can go all the way back to the Attorney General's task force in 1989 that started these laws. We know that the experts say that we ought to have a public health approach to sexual violence, just like we have towards other kinds of violence. And by that, I don't mean a soft approach. I mean a smart approach, a systematic approach that covers the range from primary prevention that looks at root causes to secondary prevention that looks at
at people who've committed crimes and are in prisons or coming out, and yes, including tertiary prevention. But tertiary prevention ought to be the last resort. It's the most expensive and generally the least effective. And I argue that that's what we've got with sex offender commitments. And here's one danger that I think comes from these sex offender commitments. We know that the model in these sex offender commitments is the mental health model. Because we use civil commitment, we're forced to talk about sex offenders in terms of the mental health model. And that means that we impose a mental illness or a mental disorder label on them. We say they're unable to control their behavior. And yet that ties in not only to the kind of self-image that many sex offenders themselves have, the kind of cognitive distortions that sex offenders themselves have, which absolves themselves of responsibility because they couldn't help it. It also ties in with old and dishonorable notions about what sexual violence is, and it ignores what we know about sexual violence, which is that it is societal values, in part, that sexualize girls, that it contribute to the root causes of at least some sexual violence. And yet, we have in these laws this notion that is really an inability to control on the part of the man that causes the violence. And here's a supermarket tabloid from 1998, how Bill lost control when that little blue dress came off. And the notion here is very serious, and it is that it was not Bill's fault, it was Monica's fault. She provoked him. He lost control. And that's the very notion that underlies these laws. So it's not simply that they violate our Constitution. It's not simply that they cost way out of proportion to their benefit. It's that they undercut some basic progress we've made in trying to understand and deal with sexual violence. One last point I want to make, and I think this is really serious also. We tend to think about sexual violence in terms of coping with recidivism. And recidivism is an important measure. It's an important indication of the scope of the problem. But we have to remember to keep it in its place. These laws, these SDP laws, put recidivism front and center and say, recidivism is the key problem. These laws push our attention downstream away from root causes to the worst of the worst. They cause us to focus on a small part of the problem. And I want to point out that recidivist sex crime is only a small part of the problem. Most sex crimes committed by released prisoners are committed by non-sex offenders. Most sex offenders in prison do not have records of sex crimes. If we look at the stream of sexual violence in a place like Minnesota, we know that there's approximately 12,000 instances of sexual violence per year. That drops by at least half when you look at reported crimes, even further for cleared crimes, and so on and so forth. And when you take a look at recidivist violence, it is a small portion of the total amount of violence in the state. When we keep our focus on recidivist violence, we ignore most of the sexual violence. Most sex offenders are in the community. Most sex offenders are released at the end of their sentence. They're not sent to civil commitment. And here is, I think, something that most of us don't realize. Most recidivists are not committed. Most recidivists are released to the community. It's just a consequence of our inability to predict accurately who is going to be a recidivist. So when we put 85-90% of our resources into civil commitment, remember that we are addressing a small part of the problem. Well, some people say, let us spare no expense. And they demonize people who would dare to criticize an effort like the sex offender commitment. What is the price of yet another victim, the innocence stolen from another child, the sense of safety at night for another woman? I share those sentiments. But do we really mean that, or do we simply mean that when we can do it in a flashy way, in a way that addresses the most obvious kind of sexual violence? Are we willing to step up and spend this kind of money for the hidden crimes of sexual violence? Well, apparently not. Here's the recent article from City Pages. The clearance rate for sexual crimes in the city of Minneapolis, that rate at which complaints about sexual violence are lead to an arrest by the police, the clearance rate has dropped from 57% in 2004 to 12% in 2007. Why? According to this article, because the number of cops on the street in Minneapolis who are investigating sex crimes has gone down from 10 to 4. Are we serious about sexual violence? Then why are we not addressing it at that level? Now, here's an email I got from Judge Kevin Burke, then Chief Judge in Hennepin County, 2004, asking for money from the legislature to deal with domestic violence. Why? Because in the last 5 years, 132 women and 68 children under the age of 13 died because of domestic violence. That, in one way, dwarfs the crimes that are saved by civil commitment. And yet civil commitment is soaking up tens of millions of dollars, and it will grow. So it's not a free choice. It is a choice that we make about where we're going to put this money. And we can put it in this very flashy program, or we can put it where it will make a wide difference in dealing with sexual violence in the community. A couple of implications for the future. So far, we haven't expanded this notion of preventive detention beyond sex offenders. Why not? Maybe we should look at quarantining released serial killers. Or a key problem, as far as I'm concerned, is racism. And Dr. Alvin Poussin at Harvard says maybe we ought to classify extreme racism as an illness. And if we did, then, of course, we could have a dangerous racist commitment bill. So the problem from my perspective is that we are basing our policy with respect to sex offenders on a morally questionable, legally questionable, and a policy that is extremely questionable in terms of its resource allocation. And I think that because of this and because of the way in which this law has developed and is being implemented, it's a big mistake for us as a state. And it may be that these laws are vulnerable as well because of the betrayed assumptions in the courts. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dean Janice, for your testimony. What do you think about indeterminate sentencing instead of civil commitment then?
I think that, Madam Chair and Senator Hillstrom, I think that we know that many sex offenders remain at risk for reoffending for long periods of time. We also know that community supervision has been identified as a key to reducing recidivism. Community supervision, of course, requires some kind of legal hold on the individual. Many experts recommend the notion of risk management as a way of dealing with the risk of sexual violence. Again, that requires some kind of legal hold on sex offenders. Indeterminate sentencing, properly done, might have that kind of benefit. In other words, it might give us the kinds of flexible control over sex offenders that allow us to titrate the kind of supervision to the risk involved. That, I think, would be a sensible way of dealing with, risk. We know that there are some downsides to indeterminate sentencing from our past experience. It involves the exercise of discretion. It has risks that it'll be misused because of that. But perhaps we've developed enough information in terms of actuarial risk assessment and so forth that we may be able to do it in a better way now than we have been in the past.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have tended to support civil commitment statutes just as I've tended to support civil commitment statutes. And so my question to you is, you know, we have an interest in as policymakers in protecting society.
Yes.
So in the event that we didn't do this,
yes,
that we no longer did civil commitment, and the people who were civilly committed were going to be let out, I don't support that, but in the event we were going to do that, we as a state don't have any hold over these people any longer. So if they get out into the community, we can't force them to do treatment because they've served their criminal sentence. Do you have suggestions or thoughts on what it is that we would do? Because, you know, frankly, the public wants to feel safe. Whether perception is real on how much of the crime is committed by those that are civilly committed, the fact is the public perception is that it is.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Hillstrom. I do have some thoughts about it. Number one, we certainly have the model. Well, let me back up a minute. Certainly, if this program were to end precipitously, there would be no hold. And I think that would be a foolish thing to do. I mean, these are men who have been locked up. They're institutionalized. They're angry. They feel their trust has been betrayed. And it would be foolish to simply put them out on the street without any kind of supervision or support. That may be the result that comes about if the laws are ruled unconstitutional. And it wouldn't be imprudent for the state to think about that possibility and make some plans for it and try to deal with it. But short of that, yes, I think clearly the model that comes from, if this is true civil commitment, then the state has the power to titrate it, has the power to say, now you're in the closed facility, now you're in the open facility, now you're in the halfway house, now you're reporting to this probation officer, to place people in a stepwise, in stepwise fashion, to greater and greater liberty and responsibility as they prove themselves able to do that. That would be the prudent thing to do. If I may, say one other thing about that. The public are not ignorant. The public can understand nuance. It takes leadership, though. And if the leaders of this state decide that it is not smart to spend $40 million a year and on up on a few, but take that $40 million and put it into the kind of grassroots and on-the-street programs that are proven to make a difference, and if the leaders stand up and say that, the public will understand it. And I'll give you an example of that. I think we should compare what happened in Minnesota over the last 2 to 3 years with what happened in Florida. Minnesota, we had a tragedy, Drew Shedin. There was an immediate reaction, understandable. 50 bills were introduced to deal with it. But I think our leaders wisely said, let's study this. Let's not act in the heat of this anger. Let's look at it more carefully and rationally, more systemically. And we had a thoughtful process that resulted in a fairly thoughtful set of legislative enactments. In Florida, they had a similar tragedy, Jessica Lundstrom. Within weeks, the Florida legislature passed Jessica's law. A whole set of drastic and poorly thought out responses. What was the difference? Well, the difference, I think, was that the leaders in this state led. And they said, you know what? If we're serious about sexual violence, we are not necessarily going to go for the flashy. Pink license plates is not going to do it. And you know what? The press followed suit here in Minnesota as well. And I think that gave space for people to enact a much more rational policy.
Other questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dean Janis, I know you're not a doctor, but you're obviously an expert in this area. I'm just trying to understand your position on kind of the science of it. Do you concede that there are some people who are not in control of their sexual impulses such that they would act out violently? Is that, I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of your worldview on this. Are you mm-hmm. do concede that those people exist?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, you know, I don't know what the question means. I'm not trying to be flip about it. If you mean that there are people who will reoffend in the future, absolutely. If you mean that they couldn't have done otherwise, I disagree. They made choices. Their brains were connected to their legs, their arms. They controlled what they did. It's not some automaton. And they were appropriately held responsible for what they did. So I'm not trying to be flip about it. I don't know what it means not to be able to control yourself under this situation, in this context.
And then, Madam Chair, if I could, just a secondary question. At the outset of your remarks, you mentioned that one thing that troubled you was the elastic and arbitrary standards. And you said specifically as to some of the medical judgments here.
Yes.
You said that, for example, some of the phrases that are used in statute or elsewhere aren't in the DSM or in other medical texts. If that were tightened, if that were made more clear, if that were made inelastic, would that lessen your concerns, or would it not really have an effect on your concerns because you think the whole regime itself, whether the definitions are tight, it, you know, is improper?
Madam Chair, Senator Simon, if the definitions were clearer, it would lessen my concerns, because one of my key concerns is this. This is a highly politically charged area, clearly. It's also a highly morally charged area. So if I were a judge, I would be hard-pressed to release one of these people because I would not want to be responsible for that person committing another crime. It's a natural feeling, absolutely. So, but we are asking these judges to make a judgment. And notice the judgment is not safe, dangerous. It's most dangerous, just below most dangerous. So all these people in the group that aren't being committed are posing some risk. And if you get all the way up to the ones right below the line, they're posing a lot of risk. So how am I, as a judge, supposed to make that judgment about where to draw the line? I'm taking total responsibility. I'm going to tend to keep pushing it down and down and down. Now, if you tell me, Judge, you commit people whose risk of reoffending is 5%. Fine, I know that. And then if I think it's 4%, I won't commit them, and I know what the law is. I'm willing to follow the law. But I doubt anybody can tell you what percent risk is enough to justify civil commitment. We just don't know. And how can we be locking up people when we don't know what the legal standard is?
Other questions? Mr. Janis, I just have a couple of comments, and that is that I agree with you that we should have a plan for a continuum of care for people to be released into. And I believe that that makes a difference in terms of the decision that's made about whether somebody should be released, is what you're releasing them to. I also am very troubled by the fact that we have not been able to release anyone, and other states that have these kind of programs have been able to safely release people. And I also have been, you know, very concerned about making sure the right people are referred for consideration for civil commitment. And I was very critical when we were seeing numbers like 8, 13, 14. But there's a wide range between 8, 13, 14, and 150 or 200. And So that concerns me greatly. In spite of all of the county attorneys telling us that they go through these cases with a fine-tooth comb, I mean, we know that there are people in, you know, these prior years who would have been committed today who were not committed then, who have not reoffended. And so I'm not sure there can ever be a science to this, but I do believe that we could do better than we are. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that really hasn't been mentioned in terms of this titrating is that now we have the ability to use GPS and other kinds of technologies that we didn't have before. And I wonder if you could make any comment on that. Are other states doing that? You know, what's the experience been?
Chair, Representative Liebling. There are some states that are using GPS and some more than others. It's certainly not a panacea. It's expensive. You need to staff it. You need to know what you're going to do when someone doesn't show up at where they're supposed to be showing up. I think it's one set of the tools that we can use. There are a number of national models. Colorado has a well-received model called the containment model. Doesn't use high technology. It does use lie detector tests. It uses treatment. It uses intensive supervision. And they've had very good luck. Here in Minnesota, we've seen our recidivism rates go down over the years. And I think many people attribute that to much more intense supervision in the community. So I think we can make use of some of the, even some of the low-tech ideas we have that are based on an understanding of how sex offenders operate and address the solution based on that knowledge.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I would, again, offer anybody, if you email me, I'd be happy to send you a copy of the book. Thank you.
Next, we'll ask Deputy Commissioner Benson and Assistant Commissioner Hoistra come up to the table.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm a Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. Very briefly, I brought Brent Wartner up here with me. He's a legal counsel that works for Corrections, and he's also the manager over the hearings and release unit. And while I don't want to get into a great deal of detail, I think it's important that you hear from him regarding the issue around keeping sex offenders in prison, particularly for longer periods of time than we would other offenders who violate conditions of their supervised release. I think that while we want to be part of the solution here too with respect to managing this group of offenders and managing the cost, I think we have to be mindful that there are constitutional issues that are important to consider as we think about appropriate changes and whether or not these people can be housed in prison, in county jail, or in a DHS facility. So I'd like to ask that we give Brent a couple of moments just to respond to a couple of suggestions.
Madam Chair, again, my name is Brent Wartner with the Department of Corrections. Part of my duties do include overseeing the hearings and release unit at the department. And earlier this evening, we heard some questions regarding how that some of the practices the department has with regards to supervising release offenders and how we conduct those hearings and what are the consequences of those hearings. And I just wanted to clarify for the record that we do handle all of the violations of offenders, whether an offender is at the Department of Human Services as a commitment, if they violate the terms of their release, a hearing is held, and a penalty is imposed that is level with the nature of the offense, the violation of the term or condition of release. The same goes for those individuals who are in the community. If there's a violation in the community, the nature of the violation is taken into consideration, and then an appropriate accountability time is imposed on that offender, and they're brought back to the custody of the Department of Corrections. There seemed to be some suggestion that somehow that an individual who was in DHS's custody somehow would receive a greater accountability time for some type of technical violation than an offender would if they were out in the community. That's just not the case. Within the statutory framework that we have in Minnesota, we follow some promulgated rules with regards to supervision and revocation of that release of an offender. It does go, it's not up to 150 days, it's up to expiration, but what's important is when an offender violates, the nature of the offense is taken into consideration. If it's a high-level offense, then they get up to expiration. If it's less than that, Minnesota follows the model of progressive discipline, and we impose a lesser amount of accountability time. So technical violations, the accountability time is lower. Severe violations that demonstrate a danger to the public, whether they're in DHS's custody or they're out in the community, they're brought back to the custody of the commissioner to expiration. So that was just a critical component that we wanted to make sure the record was clear on, that they are treated the same whether they're in DHS's custody or whether they're out in the community. It's all about aggravating and mitigating factors. There was also some discussion earlier about an offender wanting to spend their time, if they're pending civil commitment, being back in prison as opposed to being in a treatment facility. What you need to be aware of or needs highlighting is that the Civil Commitment Act in Minnesota does prohibit placement of an individual, a patient, subject to civil commitment in prison. It's laid out in Minnesota statute that they should not be placed in prison pending civil commitment. So therefore, the status of an offender who happens to be at DOC custody cannot be brought back into the prison system for no reason whatsoever other than they're civilly, there's a petition for civil commitment. The Civil Commitment Act itself prohibits that. And there's a good basis for that, as it's been touched on by some of the earlier speakers. There's concern about jeopardizing the constitutionality of the Civil Commitment Act in Minnesota when you treat something that's supposed to be remedial in nature and turn it into something that's penal in nature. The legislature, Madam Chair, and those here present, took that in consideration when the Civil Commitment Act was created in Minnesota, and it lays that out. In addition, you need to also be aware that the sentencing statutory framework within Minnesota doesn't allow the Commissioner of Corrections to have discretion on what the sentence is. That discretion is given to judges, and they impose a sentence with the framework of 2/3, 1/3. The Commissioner is bound by statute and by promulgated rule to follow that 2/3, 1/3 concept. And so bringing an offender back in because they choose to not do the 2/3, but rather do the full thing, would be contrary to the statutory framework. And that's been touched on by the courts, and they've said that an offender doesn't have that right and should not be exercising that option. So those were two areas that I thought were covered that we should at least highlight for you. And if you had any questions regarding those processes, I'd be happy to address them.
What about the idea of having people who are on hold until a commitment decision is made being held at a Department of Corrections facility rather than a DHS facility?
Again, Madam Chair, the issue goes back to looking at the Civil Commitment Act and what it says about somebody who's on an offender. Under the Minnesota sentencing framework, an offender has to be released at the 2/3 date unless there's some type of discipline occurring. So the mere fact that somebody, a civil commitment petition has been filed, is in no way a discipline. That's a status. That's not a violation covered by...
Well, I understand that, but I mean that we could change that. I mean, they're going to be held someplace.
Statutorily, it could be
changed. And they're not going to be receiving treatment while they're Well, they haven't been actually committed yet, so I mean, is it that important where we hold them?
Madam Chair, I guess I was just addressing the current status of the law.
Right, we're here talking about how we can change things to make it better.
The law could certainly be modified to reflect that an individual could be held in the commissioner's custody for that if the legislature so chose it. Presently, that's not provided for in the statute, and there may be some reasons why one would not want that to occur.
And can you think of what they might be?
Why they would...
Assistant Commissioner Benson?
Madam Chair and members, again, I think the department is open to reviewing all possibilities with respect to how we might manage this population. But I'm not an attorney, but I'm a layperson who's been watching this process since the early 1990s when I had Mr. Linehan in a house when I was a warden at Stillwater. My concern from a lay perspective would simply be I think we're adding to an already vulnerable situation if we're now going to house these people in a penal institution pending the outcome of a civil commitment petition in that now we're putting them in prison prior to, and on the other end, we're not seeming to let anybody out. So, again, my thoughts from a lay perspective would simply be, are we adding to an already vulnerable situation?
Well, Assistant Commissioner, how about the ones you're referring? That's most of them. They're already there.
It's not
I mean,
moving them.
We're not putting them in prison while they're waiting for this to be determined. We're just not moving them from prison to another facility while the courts determine whether they should be committed.
Madam Chair, but they are under sentence. They haven't reached their two-thirds mark yet in their sentence. And the law, again, as Mr. Wartner indicated, is very clear that at that two-thirds mark, they're released. And
well, let me put it to you differently. How would it be if DHS leased beds for you from you to house people during their hold order period?
Madam Chair and members, as you know, we are doing some partnering now with respect to treating these people, but they're still under a correction sentence. Now, certainly, if we had a unit that were sight and sound separated, similar to what we're doing up at our Moose Lake facility now, certainly I think that's an option that could be explored.
And what about the idea of allowing people to elect to stay at a DOC facility?
Madam Chair, my reluctance to allow that to occur is we could have these folks changing their mind every other week, depending on what kind of food we're serving them, depending on whether they're getting along with their roommate, depending on a number of things. That would be my caution and concern about allowing the offender to drive the bus.
Other questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be very interested in actually getting an attorney opinion on what impact that might have on the perception of the court of our civil procedure laws, because I wouldn't want to put them in jeopardy. But I think that if we can come up with a way to allow them to elect to stay in DOC, it is much more cost effective if they so choose. And maybe once they choose, they can't change for a year or
some period of time where
certainly I think those criteria could be set into place. The second piece is in the event that we have the ability to, you know, if we have to release it to when they reach the two-thirds date, if we could figure out what it is that we may be able to do to make it so that that isn't a mandatory release date, so that we then have the one-third sentence to use, again, that is cost-effective and not pushing out to the more expensive facility right away. So I would be interested in some legal opinions on those.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this kind of goes to what my question was before, and I want to get back to that with Mr. Was it Wartner?
Wartner. Okay. Yep, yes, Madam Chair, Representative.
Well, you know what I wasn't trying to make an equivalence, but or to say that someone who violates while they're in DHS custody should get something different than someone who violates when they're in the community. But what I was suggesting is that if the referral for commitment is being based upon some new offense they've committed or some violation that's at some serious enough level, presumably they've done something more than just a minor violation in order to trigger the commitment proceeding, the referral for commitment, that perhaps that your unit should then take a look at that there ought to be some kind of coordination there. And I'm not suggesting that we give people more punishment because there's this other proceeding going on. I'm certainly not suggesting that, because I'm very aware that we need, for a host of reasons, we need to treat people according to rules and laws and standards. But it seems to me that if there's a serious enough violation that now we're considering locking them away, or at least looking at locking them away for an indeterminate amount of time in the civil commitment procedure, that we ought to be looking at whether their remaining time then that they're being sent back for in the DOC, this however much of their remaining sentence they're going to be serving, that there be some coordination there so that it doesn't end up in that we're just holding them for a short period of time and then releasing them, and then the civil commitment proceeding is still going on. Do you get where I'm going with this? So I think this kind of also goes to Representative Hillstrom's concern. You know, can we, this is a matter of, is there a legal way that we should at that point be holding them for more time back in the DOC where the costs are less, as opposed to somewhere else? And believe me, I am not suggesting that we give them additional punishment that's undeserved. And in fact, I think I'm more on the side that Senator Berglund discussed about having some real concerns about this whole procedure, frankly. But given that this is what we've got, and what we're trying to do is bring our costs under control a little bit, what about that? Can there be more of a coordination in those cases where the violation is serious?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, what I was hoping to get across was that actually is the current practice. When there is a violation out in the community and it is of significance, that it would trigger a new review for purposes of civil commitment, that likely would be the type of nature of offense violation that would result in a finding that an offender should be brought back to expiration. Now, depending on the level, the amount of time they have remaining on supervised release, that could be 180 days, that could be 2 years, that could be more. But that is the current practice. I think I misunderstood the conversation, but the tone sounded many times the civil commitment review is based upon old information that's now being looked at more recently, and if an offender's already out and it's not a new offense or a new bad act, that alone, that new review, would not be sufficient in order to bring somebody back to expiration. But if there was certainly a new event that was of significance, that would be the case, and that's our current practice and the guidelines that we follow.
Well, I guess one of the reasons we're having difficulty with this is that one of the slides that Mr. Carlson showed us was a slide for supervised release violators subsequently referred for civil commitment. And he's got, the two largest categories are 1 to 4 years and 5 to 9 years. And this is after they've, the end of their executed sentence. So, and these would be violators, so clearly they did something that brought them back to the system, but, and they are being referred for civil commitment after that, but they've got additional time that could have been served. So that's where what you're saying and what he presented to us doesn't quite line up here.
Madam Chair, with regards to those numbers in the basis, I can't speak to why they were re-referred just because they were release violators. To me, the information that was provided did not indicate the basis for the release violation and the referral. So it's completely possible that in some of those cases, they're re-referred for civil commitment review, but that's not connected to the violation that occurred. In other words, there may not have been a prior bad act that resulted in that referral.
Could you just explain to me then the Department of Corrections policy in referring people for commitment? If they didn't do a bad act and they were not referred for commitment originally, then why would they be referred for commitment now?
Based upon...
Madam Chair, members, my name is Bill Donay. I'm the Director of the Risk Assessment Community Notification for the Department of Corrections. Some of the data that might help here is we took a look at the 170 cases that were referred by the department in 2006. 26% of those were release violators who came back as a release violator. Now, some of those may have been released for several years ago, and at that time there was a different screening process in the department. As you know, in 2005, the legislature directed the department to enhance the screening process by adding independent legal counsel to the screening process and also to create a screening committee. And so that's a different level of screening that occurred prior to that. So if an offender was released, say, in 2002, and he comes back now in 2006 for a release violation, he may well go back through that screening process and may well be referred to the county attorney based upon his criminal history and the other factors that were in existence at the time of his release. It may not necessarily be his release behavior that results in the referral. Now, there may be other cases where occasionally the release behavior is a factor, but it may not be the type of behavior that warrants a criminal sanction in accord with the promulgated rules, but it may be something that's relevant in the civil commitment screening process.
I don't understand that.
Well, for instance, an offender may have contact with minors, which may not warrant the level of consequence that in the criminal system a significant consequence, but in the civil commitment screening process it may be very significant, and so it may influence the screening committee or legal counsel in terms of their decision as to whether to refer or not. The civil commitment decision is different than the consequence decision in some cases.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment about the institution of this screening panel. The reason we went to the screening panel is because post-Dershedin, the department was referring everyone. And so the screening panel was put into place so that we stopped being everyone and started being, you know, those that the independent panel felt were necessary.
So somebody up there suggesting now we're referring more people than we did before?
Madam Chair, we are currently referring more than we did pre-Dershedin, but we're referring less post-immediate Dershedin.
Well, I'm saying they're implying that more are referred under the review panel than there might have been referred otherwise.
Madam Chair, that is correct, except right after Drew Shadeen happened, the department was referring everyone. And so the panel was put into place to bring that number back down to the ones that were needed to be referred, whereas originally there was a lower number, then everyone. It went to everyone, and then now it's back lowered, not as low as it was before, but lower than it was immediately.
Well, quite a bit higher than it was before still.
Right, but it's not everyone.
Well, take solace in that. Well, I guess the question that was raised is for these individuals, and I mean, I don't really know how many of them there are, but for these individuals that are being referred for commitment, and there is time remaining on the sentence, is it possible to create a statute that would require them to complete their original sentence before they begin to be reviewed for commitment? I mean, before they would be have their commitment executed?
Madam Chair, members, again, I think that's a question that requires lots of legal investigation, as for the reasons that have been discussed here already. Existing statute, as well as constitutional issues, as well as the vulnerability of the current civil commitment process in Minnesota in terms of, as Mr. Janis was speaking, in some of the
I think he believes the current system is not defendable constitutionally.
Pardon me?
I think he believes there's questions about the constitutionality of the current system.
And Madam Chair, what I'm saying is if, and again, I qualify myself, I'm not an attorney and I don't have the expertise, but if you modify the current system to include more penal time for those who are identified to be candidates for civil commitment, it would seem to add to the vulnerability of the system.
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it, but I guess I don't assume under our current system today that everyone is entitled to good time.
I agree.
I don't think the Constitution guarantees people good time. And that's what we're talking about here. Conditions under which...
Madam Chair, but the distinction would be that then we would be saying that those who are identified as candidates for civil commitment or are civilly committed are the ones who are not qualified for good time. And again, that casts a different light on the system of civil commitment, makes it more penal.
Well, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, but
Madam Chair,
yes,
I could think of a few others that we ought not give good time to if we need to have others.
Are there other questions? Yes, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I do see that point. I am an attorney, although, you know, I haven't obviously studied this issue from that point of view. But, you know, I do think that is a good point. But I guess I'm more troubled by the example that you gave, that we might be taking people who've been out, who've served their sentences, that have been out a while, and that perhaps have committed some kind of a technical violation. You know, obviously, say, in the example you gave, I think you said the person's been out maybe 3 or 4 years. They're into their release period, which could be quite a long period of time, because some of these sentences are long sentences. A third can be quite a few years. And they have not, to anybody's knowledge, committed a new offense. They've simply committed some kind of a technical violation, which, in my experience, can be really quite minor, something that if it was not an offender, nobody would even bat an eye. I mean, it could be something like going to the mall, for example, when you're ordered not to be in those kinds of spaces, right? So I'm troubled more that we're taking a person like that, and now we're referring them for a commitment, given, you know, what we just heard from Mr. Janis about how hard it is right now to even to make these sorts of distinctions. We've taken somebody who, by most accounts, has kind of proved themselves not to be dangerous by not committing a new offense over a period of time, and then suddenly putting them back into the system and starting the proceeding. So I guess I'm looking at it the other way, that, you know, no wonder our numbers
are going down. Well, that's why I can't. I mean, I don't understand what somebody could do that would be so bad that we put them back in prison, that would not be bad, that would also then trigger a commitment. I don't understand that.
Madam Chair, members.
I mean, even the example you gave, I understand the problem with violating the term someone's release, but I don't understand why that would trigger a commitment. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is slightly on the same subject, and you have to consider the source of where I heard this, but I heard on KQ92 the story that the Department of Corrections placed a sex offender in a hotel, and that you have that you do place sex offenders in hotels, and that apparently the offender contacted his probation officer saying, I have access to children here and access to pornographic material via the hotel TV, and that the offender was revoked. So in the event that for a violation, so in the event there's any credibility on KQRS, that would be something that I'd be interested in hearing about.
Madam Chair, members, I can't respond to that particular case, Representative, but in terms of your concerns, Representative, is we are the screening committee and legal counsel are doing our best to apply the elements of the statute in determining who is referred for commitment. And the addition of legal counsel has helped in that process, because he or she, it's currently it's he, we have two retired administrative law judges who serve in that function under contract. And As you know, we're dealing with the factors that Mr. Kerwin talked about, as well as Mr. Janis. And if the concern is that there are too many referrals, it has to do with, as Mr. Janis says, in the definitions of those factors. But we think we are applying that language as closely as possible. And if the concern is too many referrals, that language can be changed to reduce the number of referrals. It can be changed in terms of the definitions of course of harmful sexual conduct. It can be changed in the definition of a of a diagnostic history. It can be changed in the definition of highly likely to reoffend. And we will then want to apply that new language to the screening process. But at this current time, we have the screening committee and legal counsel, and we think we are applying that statute as closely as possible. And we recognize that our screening process is not a recommendation for commitment. It's a preliminary determination that a petition may be appropriate, and that determination is made by the county attorney. And so
So can I just interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
So the year we had 8 referrals, we had the same law. The standards in the law has not been changed. So are you telling me then that the year that we had 8 referrals, we had, you know, about 140 too few?
Madam
Assistant
Chair.
Commissioner.
Well, certainly the screening process has changed since the year that we had 8 referrals. And that was legislative activity that changed the screening and referral process. And,
but the criteria in the law has not changed.
I understand that, but certainly we all recall the fact that, you know, this agency was highly criticized, both over here in the media, because we weren't referring the right people, enough people. We were accused of saving money, all kinds of what I think are ridiculous accusations. And we tried to tighten it up. We absolutely did. And, you know, going forward, if we err, it's going to be, we might refer too many. We are not doctors. We don't do the psychiatric exams. We base it on the information that's before us, and we refer it to that next level. And then that level sorts out, is this individual committable or isn't he? So, you know, we're beyond that, and we're trying very hard not to continue to operate in that reactionary mode. I think we have a system and a process that's consistent with legislation that you passed. And I'm not being smug about that or not trying to pass a buck, but we are trying to put the right people through the process so that we don't have another tragedy. And I'm, you know, I'm feeling like a little bit like which way do we want to go here? And,
well,
you know, and I understand
that. Assistant Commissioner, I understand your dilemma here, but, you know, when it was 8 or 13, I said it wasn't enough. But I didn't think that meant we'd get 150. I thought maybe we'd get back to, you know, around 40 or 50 that we previously had had, that seemed to me like maybe it would be more in line with, you know, the people that might meet the definition of the law. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Benson, is the department putting people in hotels? Or is that whole story bogus?
Madam Chair, and
I mean, you all sat there with kind of like stone faces, so.
Senator Higgins, yes, there's some shreds of truth to that story. We do contract occasionally with hotels and landlords. If we have a level 3 sex offender that has to be released on a release date, has no place to go in terms of trying to manage this population and supervise this population, yes, we have placed them in hotels in the past until we can find an appropriate placement. It's, as you can imagine, it's very, very difficult to place level 3 sex offenders. It's a hotel. At least we know they're in the hotel. The agent knows where they can find them. They're not under a bridge. They're hopefully not camping under an oak tree in a schoolyard somewhere. And the other side of that issue is, you know, it's really hard to release a level 3 sex offender anywhere where there aren't children. I mean, there are children.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean,
just about
so
everywhere.
If someone is released to a hotel, that would not constitute a violation because there were children living in the hotel any more than if they were released to an apartment building.
Exactly. Madam Chair, the other part of that story was that he had an opportunity to view pornography, and there's more to that piece of the story, too. As you know, hotels, some hotels offer that through the cable system, and obviously the agent wasn't aware that that was occurring, and I don't believe the room he initially had even had a TV set. So there's more to that story. It actually was Channel 5 that aired the story. KQ picked up on it. But
I guess before we get too concerned about people being released to hotels, we need to also understand that according at least to this memo from Monica Nielsen, we have 1,700 sex offenders in Minneapolis with no permanent address, which doesn't
kind of scary
will not cause me to go home and sleep any better tonight.
Madam
so.
Chair?
Yes.
And one more question. Assistant Commissioner Benson, when I have attended the community notification meetings on the north side, and I've been to a boatload of them, some resident invariably says, you know, why did you, the DOC, put them here? And and the answer is always the DOC can't tell anybody where to go live. So once they, you know, once they're out, they have to make their own way and all of that. So that doesn't really square with the DOC places the returning offender into a hotel, in my way of thinking. What am I not connecting here?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, certainly the DOC works with the release agent to try to find an appropriate placement. And the practice is that the offender would return to the county of commitment or to the county where we have the best plan. And if there is no better plan than county of commitment, it, generally speaking, they go back to the county of commitment. And then inside of that county of commitment, the agency works with the agent. Generally speaking, it's Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, the metro counties. We try to find an appropriate placement, but many of these people simply have no place to go. And we have a small housing fund where we try to appropriately place these high-risk offenders. So again, we know where they're at. We can monitor them. You heard testimony earlier about the successes around the intensive supervision, and certainly we use that in the case of sex offenders. So we really want to know where these people are at so that we can adequately supervise them. Now, hotels are, it's a stopgap measure. We don't put them in hotels forever. But until they can get out and find an appropriate place to live, that might be an option that is used.
Madam Chair, just one more question, and then I'll stop, because we've wandered a little afield. You said that you make arrangements with the county from where they got sent away, or the county with the best plan. And I'm curious about how many counties other than Hennepin or Ramsey might actually have the county with the best plan.
I was going to say, is there a contest?
I mean, I know that they're these folks are concentrated in those two counties, and I would say they're concentrated in Hennepin. And so how many counties don't even make a good effort at working with the offender to find an appropriate place and appropriate supervision and all of that? Do we have a problem with some counties just saying, well, if we don't make our best effort, they'll all end up in Minneapolis anyway? And there's my Minneapolis bias, and then my North Minneapolis bias.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, with all these county lobbyists in the room, I don't know what it's safe for me
y'all
to answer that question. Actually, I honestly have to say that we work very well with all of the Community Corrections Act counties and CPO counties, our counties. We try very hard to find the best plan, and generally speaking, that's the county of commitment. We do have occasion where somebody from Beltrami County will get involved in something in Hennepin County. Hennepin becomes a county of commitment, but then Beltrami might be the county where the individual wants to go and reside when they get out. So those kinds of exceptions are made. Now, obviously, also, most of our offenders come from Hennepin and Ramsey County, so there's certainly a high concentration of sex offenders that go back to those communities as well. Right, wrong, or otherwise, in various areas of the city, there's more receptance to sex offenders than other areas of the city and even the state. But we work with, we have community notification meetings all over Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this was, I guess, more of a comment. I think we have confused, and I'm probably very guilty of this today, we've kind of confused two issues here. I mean, we're trying to deal with the larger issue of this whole civil commitment procedure and how many people are going through it and how many we're committing and all of that. And then the other issue we're trying to deal with is who's bearing the cost of the holds. And we've kind of wandered back and forth between the two. And I guess obviously they're very closely related.
Well, the state doesn't bear the entire cost of the holds, but we bear some of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's appropriate in terms of looking at costs.
Yes. I think we need to separate those two issues.
No, I agree with you.
But also, I just wanted to comment, too, that sometimes when I'm listening to the various parties, I'm concerned that some of the proposed solutions are being driven by whose pocket the costs are coming out of. And obviously, we're all very concerned. I mean, we know the counties are really hurting from this. They have a different...
We all are.
Yeah, we all are. We all are. But I guess I want to express the hope that we can look for some solutions that are, you know, recognizing that we're all talking about taxpayer money, however extracted from the taxpayer. You know, the issue is how is this money being extracted and from which taxpayers ultimately. But it's all taxpayer money. And so we need to find a way to not think of ourselves in silos, the different money pots here, but to try to find the most not only constitutional and effective ways to deal with this issue, but economical ways or more economical ways looking at the overall system. And, at the current time I am, during this interim, I've been involved in the criminal justice system in Olmsted County, and I am observing that a lot of things seem to be driven by whose pocket the costs are being paid out of. And that is a very inefficient way to do things often. And somehow I hope that over the longer term, at least, that we can somehow get out of that silo mentality in terms of who's paying and, you know, get things to be more efficient overall. So I just wanted to say that.
Okay. Commissioner, did you have other comments to make or other questions from our previous meetings you wanted to address?
Madam Chair, we have a handout. There were five questions. Steve Ellen is here. If you want to quickly go through that,
okay.
We certainly can to kind of put that to rest. We'll try to make short work of it here.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Ellen with the Department of Corrections. I will endeavor to give a very concise summary of the information, but please feel free to ask questions. A couple of the issues that were on the table from last time included whether or not having participated in prison-based treatment made a difference in whether or not someone was committed. And the short answer is that it depends, and the little bit longer answer is not much. If we look at those offenders who are most likely to be committed, and those are, again, identified at the front end of our process by the risk assessment team, those are all referred to the MSOP, this program up in our Moose Lake Prison. That's the program that Senator Lori and some members of Senator Berglund's staff visited recently. It's a 50-bed program up in the Moose Lake Prison that's a joint endeavor between DHS and DOC. For those offenders who were released in 2004 that we tracked subsequently, all but one of the offenders who successfully completed that program or were successfully participating at the time of release were committed. Even for those who were unsuccessful in treatment, all but one of those were committed. We have a little bit of a difference for those offenders who participated in the department's sex offender treatment programs, but I would encourage you to keep in mind that I think the takeaway point is not that the DOC's programs are different or more successful, because I don't think that's what's being considered in the courtroom. I think it's more a matter of these are the highest risk offenders that are being treated in that MSOP program. And there's charts on page 2 that summarize those numbers. There was another set of questions. And to also comment, the reason that we're looking at the 2004 group is because the dust really hasn't settled on earlier groups. We looked at, for instance, at the 2006 group, and 51% of those who had been referred for commitment were still in process. So we just don't feel like there's been enough settling of the dust to give you some good responses to that. The second set of questions had to do with those folks who didn't receive either sex offender or chemical dependency treatment for those sex offenders who were duly committed, and especially around the area of time. There were some questions of how long do these folks have. On the first page, we look at something called length of sentence versus length of stay. The length of sentence is obviously what the offender got in the first place as a consequence for the offense. Length of stay is how much time that offender now has with us. And for a variety of reasons, that length of stay can be quite different from the length of sentence. One example of that is someone that's out on probation, the community has a release violation and comes back. They may have served the majority of their sentence in the community. The statistics there are 16% of the sex offenders not receiving treatment had sentence lengths of less than 18 months, so not a very high proportion. But when we look at lengths of stay for those offenders who didn't receive treatment, 69% had lengths of stay less than 18 months, 59% had lengths of stay less than 12 months. And 62% of those sex offenders not receiving treatment were release violators, either probation or on supervised release. Turning to the back page on similar questions related to chemical dependency treatment. So for those sex offenders who are duly committed both to sex offender treatment and chemical dependency treatment, let's see, 63% of that group who didn't receive chemical dependency treatment had lengths of stay less than 12 months. About half of that group, 48%, were release violators. In addition, many of those are higher-risk sex offenders who are at our close custody facilities. Only 9% of our chemical dependency treatment beds are at close security, most of those beds. The remaining 91% are at medium. And 46 of those who didn't receive chemical dependency treatment were at our close or maximum custody facilities. So that's as concise as I could make it. Follow-up questions?
So may I just ask a question about why you have so few chemical dependency treatment beds in your closed custody facilities?
Part of the original design of our treatment programs was the idea that offenders would begin at higher levels of custody and work their way down, so to speak, through our custody levels. And to a great extent, that's true. But we have exceptions to that, and so that's why primarily we put the bulk of our treatment, both sex offender and chemical dependency programs, at our medium custody facilities. Unfortunately, there are offenders, higher risk offenders, who may reach medium custody or may never have gotten to medium custody based on their institutional conduct. The other factor that comes into play is those release violators who may come back and go straight to close custody and never have an opportunity at medium custody. And as I've previously testified, we don't have room to expand our treatment beds at close custody facilities. We recently did add programming at a Rush City facility, which is a close custody facility, but in the process we had to build infrastructure for programming space.
Okay. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And I guess the Department of Human Services does not have any further comments or presentation today. So with that, we'll just adjourn the meeting.